Iran's parliament approves all but one of President Ebrahim Raisi's cabinet lineup. China once again urges the U.S. to stop politicizing the issue of COVID-19 origin, saying that it will provide access to its labs if Washington does the same. And Israeli forces have demolished several more homes belonging to Palestinian families in the occupied West Bank. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Iran's parliament has approved all but one cabinet minister proposed by President Ebrahim Raisi for his new government. Parliament okayed 18 out of 19 picks for ministerial posts. The nominee for the education ministry was the only one who failed to earn the vote of confidence. The president will have up to 3 months to name a replacement. Raisi himself put up a final defense at parliament before the confidence vote was held. During the past 5 days, lawmakers were reviewing the qualifications of the candidates, with the nominees taking the podium to present their plans. That was followed by lawmakers taking the floor to argue for or against them. Iran says the current situation in West Asia is the result of measures by adventurous and imprudent politicians in the region and beyond. Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh said some politicians easily start wars in the region that pave the way for the growth of extremism. He noted that the West has realized that the military adventurism in the region by the U.S. and some of its allies laid the ground for the emergence of terrorist groups such as Daesh and al-Nusra Front. Khatibzadeh made the remarks on the occasion of International Day of Remembrance and tribute to the victims of terrorism. He said the Islamic Republic of Iran, since its foundation, has been targeted by various forms of political and economic terrorism. The foreign ministry spokesman called on the international community to join hands to stand by the victims of terrorism and relieve their pains. China has once again urged the U.S. to stop politicizing the issue of the origin of the novel coronavirus.
We once again urge the United States not to politicize the whole issue. I would say scapegoating China cannot whitewash the U.S. If the United States persists in hyping up the lab leak theory, then they should set an example and invite the WHO to investigate the Fort Detrick and the University of North Carolina.
The official said Beijing will provide access to its labs if Washington does the same. Fu added that the U.S. has carried out more biomilitary activities than any other country in the world. His comments came after U.S. media reported that a classified report on the origins of COVID-19 had yielded no definite conclusions. President Joe Biden had commissioned the investigation 3 months ago, saying that U.S. intelligence agencies were unsure whether the virus was a result of a lab leak or transmitted to humans via animals. In January, a team of World Health Organization experts determined it highly unlikely that the coronavirus was produced in a lab. The World Health Organization says COVID surges driven by the Delta variant are pushing health systems to the red line in the Western Pacific region.
But several countries in the Western Pacific are now experiencing surges, in part driven by the Delta variant, and our share of global cases and death is rising sharply. Surges are pushing health systems dangerously close to what we call the red line, where the number of critical cases exceeds ICU capacity and the hospitals can no longer provide the care that people need.
The WHO official said it is crucial to vaccinate priority groups such as health workers as soon as possible. He urged Western Pacific countries to respect public health measures to reduce transmission. According to the WHO, the region accounted for 10% of global COVID cases in the first 3 weeks of August. That was an increase from the original 2%. The organization says that over 6 million people across the Western Pacific have gotten COVID. Out of that, more than 82,000 have died. The Philippines and Malaysia are the hardest hit. Representative of the World Health Organization to Tehran says that Iran is among countries which has already paid for vaccines from COVAX, but the delivery of the vaccines has been delayed for different reasons. Salman Khujuri reports.
Representative of the World Health Organization to the Islamic Republic of Iran, Dr. Jafar Hussain, has visited one of the main vaccination centers in capital Tehran to closely monitor the process of vaccination. In a country where the Delta variant of the coronavirus is killing almost 700 people on a daily basis. During his visit, he learned about different phases of the process, both before and after the vaccination. The WHO representative said that despite sanctions and economic problems, Iran is among countries which has already paid for vaccines from COVAX, but the delivery of the vaccines has been delayed for different reasons.
Iran is a country which has paid already for 16.8 million doses from COVAX, already paid with all the economic sanctions, everything it is facing. The problem is that because of the major outbreaks in other part of the world, like India, like Brazil and other, the vaccine availability globally reduced. What our director general is recommending to every country head of the state, that it is a whole of society, whole of government approach to control COVID. Not only government can do it, not only WHO can do it, not only other UN, not only private, everybody has to join hands.
The number of outpatients with COVID-19 has decreased by almost 2% this week. We anticipate that the number of hospitalizations will even come down next week.
Iran's death toll from COVID-19 has exceeded 100,000. The rapid rise in COVID-19 cases and deaths in the past weeks has prompted Iranian officials to make utmost efforts to import more vaccines and accelerate the vaccination pace.
According to official reports, almost 10% of the Iranian population have already received two jabs of the COVID-19 vaccines. Experts say the pace is too slow. Accordingly, the new Iranian government has vowed to take all necessary measures to accelerate the vaccination pace and manage the pandemic as soon as possible. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Palestinians have held a mass funeral for a man who was fatally shot by Israeli forces in the besieged Gaza Strip. 32-year-old Osama Khalid succumbed to his wounds after being shot during an anti-Israel protest on Saturday. At least 40 more Palestinians were wounded by the regime forces during the protest in the east of Gaza City. They were marking the 52nd anniversary of Israel's burning of Al-Aqsa Mosque. Osama Khalid's death comes one day after another Palestinian was shot dead by Israeli troops. Imad Hashash, a teenager, was killed when Israeli forces attacked a refugee camp near Nablus, north of the occupied West Bank. Tensions have remained high in the West Bank and Gaza in recent months as Israel has escalated its crackdown against Palestinians. Our Gaza correspondent Ashraf Shannon says the silence of the international community on Israeli crimes is adding insult to injury of the Palestinian people.
Well, the apathy of the international community has been witnessed for decades, but this apathy and the silence of the international community increased rapidly following the normalization of ties between some Arab countries and the Persian Gulf region and the Israeli regime. Palestinians feel that they've been stabbed in the back by those Arabs, by the Arabs in the Persian Gulf region, and they believe that their normalization of ties and the opening of consulates and embassies, similar to that of the United Arab Emirates in Tel Aviv, only gave Israel the green light to further kill and maim Palestinians.
Israeli forces have demolished several more buildings belonging to Palestinian families in the occupied West Bank. Palestinian sources say that the regime bulldozers, backed by troops, destroyed a home in the Silwan neighborhood in East Al-Quds. The demolition of the 90-square-meter house was carried out under the pretext of lacking construction license. Elsewhere in Al-Walaja village near the city of Bethlehem, Israeli bulldozers tore down another house. A car workshop was also flattened near the city of Al-Khalil under similar pretext. Israel demolishes homes on a regular basis in the occupied territories, citing different pretexts. Palestinians and rights groups say the Israeli demolition drive is aimed at grabbing more land for settlement expansions. Two Yemeni citizens have been killed after Saudi guards opened fire at a border with Yemen's Sada province. Yemeni media say that the firing took place in the Munabi border district. Saudi forces targeted border villages with artillery and machine guns on an almost daily basis amid international silence. Riyadh, along with some of its Arab allies and backed by the U.S., launched a war in Yemen in March 2015. Tens of thousands of Yemenis, many of them women and children, have been killed ever since. Riyadh is still defying calls by the UN and rights groups to bring a halt to its cross-border aerial and ground attacks on the impoverished nation. Tensions escalate between China and the U.S. over different issues, including the South China Sea. The two world powers have once again exchanged accusations, with each side saying the other is responsible for bullying other countries in the region. We discussed that with our guests earlier in our news review program. Let's take a listen.
News Review, where we look deeper into some of the top stories of the day. On this segment of the program, China and the United States have accused each other of bullying and coercion as the two remain at loggerheads over key issues, including security in the South China Sea. Vice President Kamala Harris has called for challenging China's excessive maritime claims. She made the comments during talks with Vietnamese officials in Hanoi. Harris is there as part of her Asian tour. Earlier in Singapore, she said Beijing's actions in the South China Sea amount to coercion and intimidation. Chinese state media said Harris's comments aim to drive a wedge between Beijing and other countries in the region. The foreign ministry also reacted and accused the U.S. of hegemonic behavior. Beijing said Washington hides behind rhetoric of a rules-based global order to defend its practice. Well, joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have international independent China strategist Mr. Andrew K.P. Loing. Joining us from Hong Kong, also we have research fellow at Global Policy Institute, Mr. George Samueli. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Loing in Hong Kong. Give us your thoughts right now of the recent accusations going back and forth between Beijing and Washington.
Behind this diplomatic spread lies this kind of great power rivalry in the South China Sea. Also, let's not forget the South China Sea is China's main economic conduit for trade and importation of energy on which China's government or the China regime depends for the stability. But then with the mobilization of the military on both sides, the risk of conflict getting higher and higher. But then if you look at the visit of the Vice President Harris to two Asian countries, they're well chosen because these two countries are normally less dependent on China compared to the others, Singapore and also Vietnam. They want America's military presence in the South China Sea as a kind of hedging against China's perceived dominance. But if you look at the other countries in the South China, in the China's neighborhood, the ASEAN countries and various others, they most of them depend on China massively. All of them have China as the largest trading partner and investor. So they are unlikely to want to be on America's hymn book to antagonize China too much. But in fact, most of the countries are hedging. The reason why these two countries are chosen, because Harris is a greenhorn in diplomacy, especially she does those relatively little with the dynamics in the South China Sea. So these are safe kind of targets for her. But it's unlikely to change the kind of reality in the sense that the large number of Asian countries depend on China, forming the world's largest trading bloc, the regional comprehensive economic partnership, according to representing one-third of the world's economy and one-third of the world's population. And they have China as the central trading and economic hub. But of course, they don't want to, obviously, to be to play second fiddle to China all the time. And they want America, military umbrella. But most of the countries do not want to offend China. And Singapore and Malaysia and Vietnam are likely to be the countries which are less dependent on China.
Mr. Samueli, the United States, via the Vice President Kamala Harris, has called for challenging China's excessive maritime claims. I'd like to get your thoughts on that. Who has the excessive maritime claims? Is it China, or is it the other way around? Is it the United States? We have to look at excessive claims in Hong Kong and in Taiwan. What's going on over there?
Well, this is the one case in which the United States actually does have some claim to be speaking on behalf of rules, because after all, there was a decision by the World Court in 2016 that did say that China's claims in the South China Sea were excessive. So Harris does make a point that in saying that these claims are excessive. I mean, there's a ruling from the World Court to justify that. But I agree with the other guest, which is that the United States is having problems putting together an anti-China coalition in Southeast Asia along the lines of the famous Cold War anti-Russia coalition in Europe that actually survived the Cold War, the NATO, which is still in existence. The many countries in Southeast Asia and in Asia as a whole have very extensive commercial ties with China and don't wish to mess those up. So while countries such as Vietnam, Singapore, or the Philippines may have concerns about China, other countries are very dependent on commercial relations with China and will not want to join any kind of anti-China coalition from the United States. So this is a familiar pattern of U.S. leaders going to Asia and saying, hey, well, we've got to gather together an anti-China coalition, and the countries of Asia saying thanks but no thanks.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Andrew K.P. Long joining us from Hong Kong. Also thanks to Mr. George Samuel. He's speaking to us from Budapest. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of News Review, but do stay tuned. There's plenty more to come.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight. Disruption to the global supply chains linked to the coronavirus pandemic and Brexit have also triggered shortages of raw materials in the United Kingdom. Economists have warned that sustained supply chain problems and staff shortages could push up inflation as companies seek to pass on higher production costs onto consumers. We'll prepare for you an article by Richard Partington, under the heading, UK's COVID recovery slows amid staff and material shortages. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Britain's economic recovery from lockdown has slowed sharply in the past month despite the removal of most remaining pandemic restrictions, as businesses suffered the worst shortages of workers and materials in decades. The latest snapshot from IHS Market and the Chartered Institute of Procurement and Supply showed that growth in private sector output slowed to a six-month low in August. Problems with hiring workers and shortages of materials were 14 times higher than usual, and the worst since the survey of business activity began back in January of 1998. Separate figures from the Confederation of British Industry, CBI, showed British manufacturers suffering from the worst problems with stocks of components and raw materials in August since the business lobby group started tracking industrial production in April of 1977. UK officials claimed factory output remained resilient by historical standards in the 3 months to August, with activity driven by food, drinks and tobacco producers. However, weakness in car production, where manufacturers have struggled with global shortages of microchips, dragged on growth. Alpesh Palaya, the CBI's principal economist, said many firms were feeling the pinch from the supply chain distribution. Palaya said, despite the rebound in activity, ongoing disruptions could choke off future manufacturing growth. It's therefore vital that businesses and the government continue to work together to smooth over some of the frictions in supply chains and the wider sector until activity settles back down to normal levels. Sign that economic recovery from lockdown is losing momentum, the IHS Market and the Chartered Institute of Procurement and Supply Flash Purchasing Managers Index dropped to 55.3 in August from 59.2 in July. Any reading above 50 indicates expansion. It comes despite the easing of most remaining pandemic restrictions on 19th of July. Chris Williamson, the chief business economist at IHS Market, said raising coronavirus infections were deterring consumer spending, while businesses were struggling with acute supply shortages. Chris Williamson added, the number of companies reporting that output had fallen due to staff or material shortages has risen far above anything ever seen previously in more than 20 years of survey history. He added, in manufacturing, sectors including automotive production and electrical goods have fallen into decline due to mainly supply constraints. Job vacancies across the United Kingdom have risen to record levels in recent months, while many firms have been forced to temporarily close or reduce production after staff were pinched by the NHS COVID app. Disruption to global supply chains linked to the pandemic and Brexit have also triggered shortages of raw materials in the United Kingdom. Economists have warned that sustained supply chain problems and staff shortages could push up inflation, as companies seek to pass on higher production costs onto consumers. The IHS Market Survey of 1,300 manufacturers and service sector companies, which is tracked by the Bank of England and the Treasury for early warning signs from the economy, showed employment rising at the fastest rate since the survey began. Firms responding to the survey said there was growing pressure to raise wages in the hunt for new recruits. There were also widespread reports that rising shipping costs and shortages of raw materials had led to intense price pressures. However, the rate of inflation for input costs eased to a four-month low in August, while factory gate prices rose at the slowest pace since May. Duncan Brock, a group director at CIPS, said the shortages were beginning to feed through into higher wages and increased shipping costs. He said an abnormally large slowdown in overall activity in August offers a stark warning to the UK economy that the accelerated levels of growth we've seen earlier this summer are not sustainable. Figures published earlier on Monday, 23rd of August, showed a similar picture in the Eurozone, although private sector activity managed to remain at stronger levels than in the United Kingdom, despite widespread supply chain delays. This pulled markets' flash composite PMI for the Eurozone down to 59.5 in August from a record high of 60.2 in July. Samuel Toombs, the chief UK economist at the consultancy Pantheon Macroeconomics, said UK goods export orders grew at a significant slower pace than in the Eurozone for the 8th consecutive month. He said this highlights that Brexit has impeded the British economy's recovery. Private sector output in the US economy also slowed sharply in August, as supply constraints held back growth in the so-called world's biggest economy. The IHS Market Flash US Composite PMI fell to 55.4 in August from 55.9 in July, hitting an 8-month low. Meanwhile, according to official data, deaths from COVID-19 are now averaging 100 a day across the United Kingdom, and scientists have warned that case rates will jump again when millions of school pupils return to school next week. Figures released by Public Health England on Monday 23rd of August shows the 7-day average for deaths within 28 days of a positive test now stands at 100, a number that was last exceeded on 18th of March. Although the vaccination program means deaths are far below the peak of last winter, the highest daily total was 1,248, reported on 23rd of January. It is a notable rise from late May and early June, when they were consistently in single figures. Confirmed infection numbers have also started to rise once more, following a dramatic fall in mid-July, with 31,914 cases reported on Monday, 23rd of August, the 7-day average figure having increased 13% from a week before. Hospitalizations have risen from 672 on 31st of July to 948 on 17th of August. Adding to the concern is the expectation of increased infection rates when students return to school and colleges across England, Northern Ireland and Wales, which mainly happens next week. Cases in Scotland, where most school pupils went back last week, have risen dramatically, going up from 799 on 2nd of August to 3,190 on Sunday, 22nd of August. While the return of school may have played a role in the rise, it is unlikely to be the only factor, as they reopened so recently. Some scientists have warned that a likely increase in COVID-19 cases in autumn and winter, coupled with other viruses, could require the return of mitigation measures, such as wearing face masks.
We try to get close to whom Imam al-Hussein actually is.
Verily, in the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, there is a warmth in the hearts of the believers that will never cool off.
Imam Hussein alayhi salam sees that the evil system is starting to institutionalize itself.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Ya Tabibi, Sayyidi Mawla Hussein. Ya Habibi, Ya Tabibi, Sayyidi Mawla Hussein.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagian.
Sallallahu alayka ya Abu Abdullah. Ruhi fidaka ya Mawla. Inshallah, Imam al-Hussein accepts from all of you and all of us this gathering of commemoration, inshallah, the Lady Fatima to Zahra, salamullahi alayha, accepts from all of you and all of us. And hopefully, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, through the various parts of these commemorations, the emotional attachments, the emotional connections, the beating of our chest, the nawhas, all of it, inshallah, this gets us closer and closer to where we want to be there. We want to envy Habib ibn Madahir. We want to envy Qasim ibn al-Hasan. We want to envy the Ashab Zuhair ibn Qin. We want to envy the people that were there and say to them, really, Ya laytana kunna ma'akum. We wish we were with you. That's the effect of the majalis of Abu Abdullah al-Husayn. That is what keeps Islam alive. That is what makes a Shia of the Ahlul Bayt, a Shia of Imam al-Husayn, the invincible. It makes the Shia of Imam al-Husayn, despite all the odds, we have nothing, they have everything. We will win the same way Abu Abdullah al-Husayn. With his Shahada, he won the battle. Imam al-Husayn won the battle with his Shahada, brothers and sisters. This is important. He didn't win it in the way that the material-minded people thought a war would be won. Imam al-Husayn accomplished what he wanted to. It's not like he came there, he said, help me, and nobody helped him. They slaughtered him. Now we cried because of defeat. He wasn't defeated. Imam al-Husayn wasn't defeated. Imam al-Husayn's blood saved Islam. That's what his objective was. His objective was nothing beyond that. His objective was not to protect his life. His objective was not to rule for the sake of ruling. His objective was not to get rid of Yazid because he wanted to be the ruler. That's why he said, I am not rising for corruption. These personal gains, these material wants and desires and temptations, is to save Islam. Did he save Islam? Absolutely. He won with his blood. That's why he said, if the Islam of my grandfather can only be saved with my blood, فَيَا سُيُوف خُذِينِي, swords, come and take me. This is the spirit of Muharram, the spirit of Abu Abdullah al-Husayn. This is what has caused, brothers and sisters, the global dominant powers that gained superiority because of their efforts for the dunya, technological advancements, industrial revolution, gained all of that to do what? To loot the world of everything they have. Of everything they had, one of the areas that they have influenced the people of the world, not one area or the other, is that they stripped them of their culture and gave them their own culture. They say the Prime Minister of Japan came to the U.S. He was more adamant about visiting Elvis's estate compared to the Elvis lovers of the U.S. at the time. I don't know exactly when this was, what year. I remember. It was in recent history. That's how bad it is. I mean, Elvis, who's Elvis? That's pretty old. In the 90s, when somebody's looking for Elvis, that shows how backwards you are. But this is what it is. When a Japanese person no longer reveres Japanese heroes, Japanese culture, Japanese language, dressed in Western attire, listens to Western music, Western messages, Western designs, the people of the world have been affected with this. You think they didn't want to affect the Muslimin? It's not about changing the color of the hijab. They don't care about whether you wear a suit or you wear this clothing. These are all means. These are symbols. They don't want any culture that is going to stand against them or even just simply not follow them. They tried very hard. They tried very hard in so many different ways. The voice of Imam Khomeini could still be heard. I don't know if you've seen those images. In the center, one of the centers of Tashayyu', one of the centers, we know that as a country, these borders don't really, these are not Islamic borders, but these are unfortunately what we're dealing with these days, within a border of what is called a country, the country that has had a dominant majority Shia, dominant majority Muslim, and then dominant majority from amongst them Shia, is Iran. All the other countries with the large numbers of Shia they have in terms of percentage, it's not as dominant as it is in Iran. In that country, they passed a law that a marja of the Shia could be disrespected or even killed by an American or even an American dog unleashed by its owner, and an Iranian court does not have the right to bring this man to justice, or woman, whoever it is. They don't have a right. You're selling your soul. This is what it was in Iran. Imam Khomeini called ulama of Islam, respond to Islam, come forward for Islam. They're killing Islam. The other center of tashayyu, the city of Najaf, long history of tashayyu, and the Hawzat, not just as many cities in Iraq and other areas in Lebanon, there's cities in Syria have had a long history of tashayyu, like Halab. Cities in Pakistan and Afghanistan that are known, other areas, these are just some examples, Azerbaijan, other countries, or cities. In terms of country, we said this is, it seems like, as far as my knowledge goes, the city of Najaf, all this history, as we just said, from the time of Amirul Mu'mineen, this is one of the strongholds of the Shia. Can you imagine Kufar, the British, marching triumphantly into Najaf and saying, we spare you, we won't come into the Najaf? That's the most disrespectful way of an arrogant military that has defeated you. They say, we spare you, we won't come into Najaf. What Islam meant. All that effort to get rid of the voice of Imam al-Hussein, to get rid of the commemorations of Imam al-Hussein, to get rid of the spirit of Islam in the heart of any Muslim that says, Hayhat min al-dhilla. They tried so hard to get... What caused them not to be able to do that? Instead, not only in the Islamic Republic of Iran because of the revolution of Imam al-Hussein, but in Iraq, the parliament tells this bully, this so-called global power, you need to take your military and leave. After the shahada of Shahid Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis and Haj Qasim Sulaimani, they have the courage to stand and say, you need to get out of this country. Japan, post-Second World War, has been where the Americans have done whatever they've wanted. And the Japanese people on the Okinawa Island and elsewhere have had protests against their presence upon protests because of, if not nothing else, just the mistreatment of the people. All the stuff that is even silence on the media, plenty of it happening. Japanese government hasn't been able to stand up to this superpower and say, you need to get your military out of here. We don't want it here. What gives that strength? In Lebanon, Hezbollah, this small group of people, kicks the Zionist regime, which has all of the support of the what they call the global community, which means the global bullies, the US, the British, the French, the Germans that are right behind them. What causes them to be able to stand? And now, tashayyu, Islam of Ali ibn Abi Talib, Islam of Hussein ibn Ali, Islam of the Ahlul Bayt is on the rise. Why? Because of this type of Muharram. Because this message of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein takes away that fear that causes all others to hush up and not stand, the same way Imam al-Hussein did not hush with all that opposition. Say, Faya Suyuf Khudini. If Islam needs my blood, these mu'mineen, these followers of the Ahlul Bayt in these Muslim lands and wherever they're standing, if Islam needs my blood, then Faya Suyuf Khudini, they've learned from Imam al Hussein. This is the effect of Karbala, this is the effect of Imam al Hussein.
Ya Hussein, Ya Habib, Ya Hussein, Ya Habib, Ya Hussein, Ya Habib, Ya Hussein, Ya Habib.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
It is ridiculous for the United States to chase after its own vaccine skeptics without at the same time doing more to bring the benefits of this scientific achievement to the rest of the world. We now present you an article written by Jeffrey Frankel, a professor of Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government. The piece is titled, G20 Must Prioritize Global COVID Action at October Meeting. Finance ministers, central bank governors, and political leaders are hard at work preparing for the 2021 G20 Heads of State and Government Summit in Rome, Italy, on 30th and 31st of October. With the COVID-19 pandemic stretching well into its second year, the meeting will come at a time of heightened uncertainty about public health and the global economy. And though the mechanisms of international cooperation have been weakened by the pandemic and remain bruised by Donald Trump's legacy, they are more important than ever. Cooperation need not refer to international coordination of national monetary or fiscal policies. For the most part, countries on their own can move those levers in whatever direction is best for them. Instead, the G20 should focus on financial stability, trade, and vaccination. This is in addition to other important areas, especially the existential issue of global climate change, which should and will receive a lot of attention. Over the course of 2020, most countries responded to the health crisis and economic recession with government spending. But emerging markets and developing economies, EMDEs, cannot finance deficits as easily as can Europe and the United States, with its exorbitant privilege conferred by the dollar's global dominance. Fortunately, many of these countries managed to meet the acute need for increased spending without having to pay sky-high interest rates. Owing to the aggressive monetary stimulus provided by the US Federal Reserve and other major central banks, the initial declines in emerging markets and developing economies, EMDEs, currencies, security prices and commodity prices in March of 2020 were reversed after the US Federal Reserve's easing. But now it is August of 2021, and every country must contend with a higher debt for GDP ratio. At some point, the US Federal Reserve will signal an end to monetary easing and a coming increase in interest rates. Whenever that happens, investors will pull out of risky assets and lose enthusiasm for their emerging markets and developing economies, EMDEs. Suddenly, EMDE debtors could face potential financial crises like those that struck in the 1980s and 1990s, or on a lesser scale, like the 2013 taper tantrum, when the U.S. Federal Reserve triggered EMDE capital flight by suggesting that it will soon start to wind down its asset purchases. Accepting that there may be a bubble component to today's high prices for risky assets, the financial situation appears particularly fragile. Some say that soaring markets reflect economic fundamentals. For example, high price-to-earnings ratios in the United States stock market are said to be justified by the promise of digitalization and other productivity-enhancing technological innovations. But I would point to the surge in some financial innovations that do not enhance productivity. Think of the 6,000 old cryptocurrencies that have been created, and the rise of meme stocks, special purpose acquisition companies, and non-fungible tokens. In any case, the G20 can help to reduce the likelihood and severity of a potential emerging market debt crisis. The debt service suspension initiative that it created during the pandemic was the first step, but it only postponed repayment, and only for one class of international creditors, governments. It is widely recognized that provisions for possible debt restructuring should be extended to cases where the international creditors are private financial institutions, or where Chinese state-backed lenders are claiming to be private. A second step is the new allocation of special drawing rights agreed to by International Monetary Fund IMF members recently. Both initiatives come just in time for emerging markets and developing economies, EMDEs. Early on, it appeared that the impact of the pandemic would be more severe in advanced economies than in many EMDEs, with the exception of South America. But rich countries have since enjoyed unusually strong economic recoveries, aided by macroeconomic stimulus and the vaccines. Meanwhile, the other half has fallen behind. In its most recent global outlook for July of 2021, the International Monetary Fund predicted continued strong growth for advanced economies, but marked down its growth forecast for emerging markets and developing economies, EMDEs. Among developing countries, millions of people are being thrown back into extreme poverty. This economic divergence is particularly striking because it comes on the heels of a global convergence. On average, emerging markets and developing economies, EMDEs, had been growing substantially faster than advanced economies from the turn of the century until 2014, when Chinese growth started to slow and dollar prices for commodities fell. Among the many explanations for the catch-up period is that global trade increased roughly twice as fast as gross domestic product GDP during the decades preceding the 2008 global financial crisis. However, since 2009, the trend for the trade to GDP ratio has been flat. Unfashionable, as it is to say, the situation today calls for some old-fashioned trade liberalization. The United States and China should roll back the protectionist barriers that they raised over the last 4 years. One sector that is especially ripe for liberalization is trade in environmentally beneficial products, such as the equipment used to produce wind and solar power. G20 member states should work with the World Trade Organization, WTO, to establish new international rules guiding carbon border adjustment taxes so that they can be used but not abused. The G20 also should work with the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, to follow through on the exciting recent progress towards the Global Framework for Corporate Taxation. Most importantly, the United States and other rich countries must allocate more of their massive spending packages to make COVID-19 vaccines available to low- and middle-income countries. It is ridiculous for the United States to chase after its own vaccine skeptics without at the same time doing more to bring the benefits of this scientific achievement to the rest of the world. Ruchir Agarwal and Geeta Gopinath of the International Monetary Fund have proposed a plan of action to get more vaccines produced and distributed throughout the world. Even someone who is allergic to altruism should favor programs for vaccination in other parts of the world. So long as the coronavirus runs wild anywhere, it is a danger everywhere. The stakes of international interdependence are higher than ever.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Why did Imam Hussein take his family to Karbala? Imam Hussein was aware of the consequences of his movement. He was an infallible Imam. Infallible Imam's extensive knowledge and insight are beyond our heads. If those great tragedies had not happened to the shrine of the Holy Prophet, to Imam Ali's daughter, and to the Holy Prophet's descendants, this event would not have gone down in history. The event that could have prevented that great deviation had to shock people and history as much as the deviation did. This shows Imam Hussein's self-sacrifice. Of course, this is easier said than done. What Imam Hussein did was an extraordinary feat. That is to say, the dimensions of his action are far more than what we estimate. We usually ignore aspects and details. Once I spoke about Imam Hussein's patience, his patience was not limited to enduring thirst or seeing his companions being killed. These things are relatively easy to tolerate.
Ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum. أنا لا تشان
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
أنا لا تشان أنا لا
The kind of patience that is difficult to practice is to listen to influential, aware and respectable people who keep creating doubts and telling you that what you are doing is dangerous and wrong. Who did those things? People like Abdullah Ja'far, Abdullah Zubair, and Abdullah Abbas. These prominent figures of that time were constantly telling Imam Hussein not to do what he was doing. If it were somebody else, somebody who did not have that determination and stable character, he would have thought, well, I did my duty. These people are talking like this and the world is acting like that, so I should just say what I'm supposed to say and do nothing else. A person who decides to stand up against such statements, such temptations, such doubts, and such efforts to bend Sharia and is not dissuaded from continuing his path, such a person is the one who can give rise to such a great transformation. In this regard, our magnanimous Imam was similar to the Lord of the Martyrs. I explained this in another meeting, and I do not want to go into the details now. This was how Imam Hussein acted as a guardian. July 4th, 2011.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.